Sandy Alomar Jr. is a six-time All-Star and current first base coach of the Cleveland Guardians. He was one of the building blocks that helped fuel the baseball renaissance here in Cleveland in the early 1990s. I sat down with Sandy recently, and we talked about a myriad subjects about his career. What were the origins of Sandy in Major League Baseball? Let's begin with the time that he was traded from the San Diego Padres organization to Cleveland prior to the 1990 season. You know, we go back so many years. It was after the 1989 season, you were traded here in one of the best trades in Cleveland Indians history. Take me back to that date. What was it like for you as a young kid getting the word that you're going to Cleveland?
Well, the funny part about this is that there's a few people in the Cleveland organization that had to do with this trade that have something to do with it. One is Mike Hargrove, and the other one is Louis Isaac.
Oh, sure.
And the reason I say that is because when I played winter ball, I was playing winter ball for the at that time I was playing for Ponce, but I was playing before with Santurce, which Louis Isaac was one of the current coach at that time for the Cleveland Indians, mm-hmm. was a coach for the Santurce Cravers. So he always loved the way I caught, and he knew that I was a prospect. Then when I played, I was with Las Vegas with the Padres organization. I played against Grover. Grover was in Colorado Springs with the Indians. I played against him. And there was a lot of track record because Grover played with my father. And I remember one time that I was the 1988 Minor League Player of the Year, Sporting New Minor League Player of the Year. And then 89, I came in. I started slow because it sent me down. Like, I was kind of a little bit bummed out that I didn't make the big league club. But I knew they had Benito Santiago there. And I kind of started like real slow. And Grover was playing against me, and I didn't have good at bats. And he called me the next day in batting practice, even though he was my rival manager. He goes like, "Hey, I need to talk to you." I go, "What's up?"
"What's up?"
I say, "You're too good of a player. You gotta get your head out of your ass." And I'm like, "Whoa," you know, knowing that he played with my dad and they had that there's our relationship. He cared about it. So in that winter of '89, I end up being minor league player of the year. Again, Grover.
And you're sitting there going, "What more do I have to do? I'm minor league player of the year 2 years in a row, and this guy Santiago, I'm never going to get past him."
So we knew one of the guys was going to be moved. I knew I was a cheaper guy, and Benito was a proven catcher. So like, I knew that either I was going to get traded, was going to be with San Diego, or he was going to get traded. But I figured that I never in a million years thought I was going to be to Cleveland. But Grover had a lot to do with it because in a winter meeting, he was pushing for that. He was coaching first base for the Indians at that time. And when I got traded, I was like, I was super ecstatic. I wanted to play for the Padres, but I was super ecstatic that somebody was going to give me an opportunity to play in the big leagues. And I remember the first Tri-Fest when I came, and it was like 20 degrees. I'm like, "Holy cow, this is crazy over here." And I didn't know anything about Cleveland. The only thing I knew about Cleveland was that I knew when I played winter ball, there was few players that belonged to the Cleveland Indians organization, like Ron Pruitt, Charlie Spikes,
oh,
I remember.
Gosh. Wow.
They went play winter ball, and I knew that Louis Isaac was in the organization, so that's the only thing I knew about it.
Wow, that was it.
Yeah.
But yet you grew up in the game of baseball. We all know that your dad, Sandy Alomar Sr., was in the game. And you've been a baseball lifer.
Correct.
And so take me back to your childhood, just what that was like. And then we can get you into the majors and get you to Cleveland.
Oh, yeah. That was an incredible childhood because not only the opportunity to come here and watch Major League Baseball and grow up in a Major League locker room, from having a former father to play Major League Baseball, but also going to winter ball games in Puerto Rico was crucial because at that time, in that era, Major League players went to play winter ball to get better.
Yeah.
There was no like this, I'm going to condition, they go play all year round. That's why the development of the player was accelerated during that time because the player went play with good competition in winter ball. And I got a chance to see Tony Perez, Frank Robinson, He was the manager for my dad in winter ball too.
Oh,
wow. You know, Juan Benitez, Eli Rodriguez, Louis Isaac. I had the chance to see also Gary Carter play winter ball. So all these people, all these Major League Baseball players were playing winter ball in Puerto Rico to develop.
Wow. And so did you have Major League aspirations as a kid, or you just said, I love this game of baseball and I'm just going to keep playing it, whether or not I get drafted or those types of things, we'll let it nature take its course?
The last part you say was it. I was in love with the game, but it was not. I wasn't thinking about, am I going to be a baseball player? Because baseball was there in front of me all the time.
Yeah.
My brother was different. He was just all in. Like I was more worried about getting good grades and stuff like that. He was more worried about becoming a Major League Baseball player. So, like,
okay.
I did love the game. I kind of left it for a little bit. I did other things because I want to enjoy my childhood. But at the end of the day, the passion that we have as a family for the game kind of brought me back in. Didn't know I was going to be a Major League Baseball player, but I feel like the opportunity was there.
Yeah, and you just took advantage of it because you had the skills and you got better and better as time went on.
Yeah, I was a little bit of a late bloomer.
Play other sports?
I play volleyball. I did taekwondo. I rode dirt bikes. I enjoyed my childhood. You know,
cool.
And I had to work, too, to buy my products. Like, I delivered the papers. I used to shine shoes, work at my dad's gas station in order to buy my dirt bike.
Oh, cool.
So it was my dad did not say, you want a dirt bike, you got to get it yourself. So, but I used to get up early to deliver the newspaper when people used to have the newspaper get delivered to their homes.
Yeah, those days seem like they're years and years ago. We're of the same ilk because I was a paper boy mm-hmm. myself. Did you ever get those days where you go, did I deliver to that house? I can't remember. I forgot whether or not I gave them the paper.
Hey, I tell you what, that one time I was delivering, I used to get up, my dad used to get me up at 5:30 in the morning because I had to be in school by 8. So I used to get up 5:30. It took me like a half an hour to get ready. I used to roll those paper and put them in a, remember the Coca-Cola, those loops, those plastic
yeah.
loops?
Yeah,
I used to put those newspaper in a loop and have it back. And I used to go to his house all the time. There was a straight dog that used to chase me all the time. I used to panic all the time. So I had to start gaining speed now because I had to shoot the paper a couple of times. I overshoot because the dog was chasing me. But at the end of the day, it was fun times, and I ended up going back to baseball because, you know, the passion was calling, and I was a little bit of a late bloomer, but at the end of the day, I got it done.
That's cool. I guess that was just preparing you for when you were crouched behind the plate and you had to throw some guy out at second base.
So I really was my dad always preached that you should be a catcher because you're basically like a natural. You have a natural ability to block balls. For some reason, as a kid, I never was afraid of the ball.
Oh, wow.
So one of the Christmas, he got me I remember I idolized Thurman Munson because he played with my dad with the Yankees, and I like his catching gear, orange and black. So for Christmas, I ordered a catching gear that had the orange and black. My dad got it for me, and that was it. I was hooked to catching ever since. I was like seven years old, and I became a catcher since then, and I love the position. And it really, really, if you play catcher since you're in little leagues, you fight hard and you work hard, mm-hmm. you can become a major league catcher.
We'll get to maybe how you work with you're working with a catcher for the Guardians right now, who's got to get better at blocking mm-hmm. balls in the plate. But let's stay back where you're a young guy. You're getting, you know, you get signed. You become a major leaguer. You're minor league player of the year for a couple of years in a row. You get the shot to go to Cleveland with the Indians. Now, Lofton would come later, but not mm-hmm. much later. But mm-hmm. it was basically you and Carlos that mm-hmm. were the early parts of the team. And then Charlie comes along as well.
Yes, I was just welcoming the opportunity. I wasn't looking at what the standings. I wanted to make a difference everywhere I go.
Mm-hmm.
Or everywhere I went, I should say. Because the last 3 years in the minor league system, we won 2 championships. So I had the kind of like the winning attitude already coming from San Diego. And Carlos Barriga was the same. He had the passion for the game. And in reality, Carlos was one of the top prospects for the San Diego organization because he was a great hitter. Defensively, he was kind of iffy. That he didn't have a position third or second, but he kind of developed into a great second baseman afterwards. But his bat was special.
Yeah,
So coming with somebody that that I was familiar with, coming with me over here, also Chris James came over, it made it a lot easier for me.
Okay, and so you guys come along, and the groundwork is starting to be laid there for the franchise. You know, John Hart comes into the picture, mm-hmm. And then more and more guys come in. Lofton by the trade, Jim Thome comes on board. What was the atmosphere like as you kept adding those pieces and got better and better?
Honest to God, it reminded me of now.
Okay, well, I wanted to draw that conclusion.
This group of guys, they're confident, they're like kind of cocky a little bit. And I used to look around and say, dude, we're not winning yet. We haven't, you know, like, I remember in 93, this guy had a swagger. And out there yelling at the pitcher and stuff like that. I guess my people are going to get drilled on this team. But they brought that swagger. Teams knew that we could run. Team knew that we were exciting.
Yeah.
And the one thing that got us better is like what Tito Francona does now is just like we make teams play to our speed because we were young.
Yeah.
And when other teams...
You're like a basketball team that fast breaks all the time.
Yeah. So we were that. Major League Baseball didn't know that then. Yeah. Other than the San Luis Cardinals. Every time San Luis come in, everybody go, get ready, strap it on because these guys are going to run.
Yeah.
And Montreal Expos too with team reigns and stuff like that. But and Andre Dawson and... And we built a team that was like very athletic and with power. The pitching was coming around, but at the end of the day, the transformation and the structure of the team, it was great planning.
It was so much fun covering and because you guys you're getting better as years went on. You added more and more pitchers that the late Steve Olin, mm-hmm. Of course I mentioned Thome, then Manny comes into the picture, mm-hmm. of course Albert. As well develops. What a collection of characters.
Incredible. Let's add up Omar Vizquel to that.
Oh, I forgot about Omar.
To that group. He's a major character.
Well, he came in 94.
Yeah, correct. You
know, and, you know, boom, right away.
Yeah, he was a big part. Him and Kenny are the two igniters in our team. I mean, we talk about Manny. We talk about Manny and Thome and Albert Bell being the power guys. Yeah. The one thing, you just don't win games just doing one thing. Okay. You have to be diverse. You have to be able to run, create runs, and we were that team. We were able to beat you different ways. When Kenny Lofton came to our team, you can see that the way the opposition was pitching to us, they got disrupted. So he caused a lot of different ways of pitching. Guys are trying to rush. They make a lot of mistakes, and Manny and Albert and Thome benefited out of that.
Several Sage veterans were acquired by the team to help teach these young players how to win baseball games. They had a new ballpark. It was selling out each and every night. It was the place to be in Cleveland, but they still had to produce.
Sandy, so you got all these Sage ball players, Eddie Murray, historical figure, obviously Oral Hershiser. What were some of the ways that they kind of got in your heads or at least taught you to play more and more winning baseball?
Now we used to play baseball, and we were always like playing seven-inning games, and after that we collapsed. It's just two innings, those championship innings that you have to win in order to be in postseason. So they were kind of like more force you to prepare more. Like basically you have to go through the report, check it out to the last minute. And Eddie is like always telling you, oh, this guy does this and that. You know what the guy's going to do to you? So basically get into plan and what the guy's going to do to you before you get into that box. And you go out there and just hack. So you have to have a plan according to how the guy is going to pitch you. I mean, obviously it's something natural, but they were more like into details of pitch by pitch. Okay. And that's the part that when you're young, you tend to lack at times. So that you don't kind of review everything they had done to you in the past and stuff like that.
So back then, this organization was getting more and more into the numbers, the metrics, this team does this towards you. Let's keep that in mind. And it's so much more prevalent nowadays. I would assume that you're even more detail-oriented as you guys prepare these young players for games.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much data, instant data right now, that it's kind of like, at times, I call it paralysis by analysis.
Okay, well,
because
you're not the first. Sammy.
Yeah, so there's so much you can throw to a player. I think you have to kind of limit the amount of information right now that you give a player and simplify it to the way that they can understand it. And that it gets filtered from the front office, the people that do the analytics, and also the coach and the coaches to the players, obviously. But you have to cherry pick which one is going to help that player at that particular time. There are so many things the player has to do to prepare that you just don't want to put, especially a player that are kind of like going through turbulence, like you don't want to put him through a situation that they have to overthink.
I see. So overthinking is not a good deal. And you're so right. Analysis by paralysis. My gosh, I watch the NFL on Sundays and you think, can they prepare any more? There's not enough hours in the day for how much they want to prepare. But yet you still have to go out there and make the tackle, block the guy, you know, catch the ball, throw the ball. And maybe we get a little bit too crazy with the analysis. All right, we got to get back to 1995 because that was such a fun year. Mm-hmm. How did you guys coexist? You had so many different personalities, of which the biggest one that everybody, the kind of like the 900-pound monster in the building that we had to think about a lot was Albert, because he was a very unique, dynamic individual. How'd you deal with him, and how did you police each other?
The thing about it is, in the locker room, we got along very well, and we didn't have any issues. And Albert, you hardly ever saw Albert in the locker room because Albert had his routine. He was mostly in the cage and preparing and the things that I was talking about. He always kind of like limit the doubt he's going to have through the game. Albert used to chart his pitches. Every single pitch. I don't remember if you remember that incident here with Bud Shaw, that Bud Shaw was looking at his locker to see if he sees those cue cards, and Albert busted him. I had to interview in that one because Albert wanted to kick his butt. I'm like, Albert, you're not going nowhere with this. This is not a good, these people just want to explore you. They want to see what makes you thrive. So he understood. He was never in the locker room. We never had issues with him. He threw a tantrum here and there, but he was just like a motivated guy that wanted to produce. And that's how he was a driven person. But when it came to preparation, he was one of the best I ever seen. Him, Manny, Tommy, those guys were always grinding to prepare to put in good at-bats. Now, did Albert have incidents off the field and some in the field? Like he threw a ball to a fan had a warrant for his arrest also. And
do you remember that day?
Yeah, I remember that day.
Sandy, I was at the TV station after the game, and the fan calls me and says, I'm the guy that got hit by Albert Bell's ball. The fan was still drunk. I mean, let's be honest. And this guy was egging him on. He was egging on a guy who was an alcoholic, who was trying to stop drinking, who was trying to change his whole life. And I thought the guy went overboard, but obviously Albert did what he did. And that could have been a super ugly moment.
And then I find out, and the guy has surgery too. He had stitches,
when he showed me his chest, he came to the TV station and showed me his chest. Took his shirt off, and right in between his breast was, you saw all the stitches of the baseball. I mean, that's how hard Albert threw the ball. He's very lucky he didn't kill that guy.
Yeah. So the reality thing is, like, I know that it's kind of like a difficult situation to see a player throwing a ball. But all fun aside, I mean, like, Albert, you hit the cutoff man for once. So he could have killed that guy if he hit him in the head.
they didn't get Albert Bell for how he played the field. I mean, that one year he had, the 50-50, and he wasn't the MVP. I mean, that probably says all you need to know about what the media thought of this guy. He was a tremendous talent.
Yeah, I don't think Albert cared about MVPs. He cares about being the most productive player he could be and help the team win. I don't think that Albert, if you talk to him right now, I've seen him a few times. He's completely a different guy. He's more a family guy now, and he's grown out of that. But he was just a complete driven guy. He was like, I say, man, you You out there trying to destroy that ball. If that's what it takes, should I get angry too? Because he was good.
So there were some celebrated issues, you know, when he busted up an infielder, you know, in one game because he was in his way.
That wasn't Milwaukee.
He was always making a point, wasn't
he? Okay, let me go back to that play, okay?
Did you instigate that?
No. You know who instigated that play? It was Eddie Murray. Okay. And speaking of that, so like the first inning, the same play happened. Chopper, he always taught as a runner that when it's a chopper, you either stop, don't let the guy tag you, or just like run through it because you don't want the guy or fall down, so you don't want the guy to touch you, then throw the ball to first base. You got to disrupt the fielder.
Got it.
So that play happened. Albert stops, Vina comes in, tag him, and then throws the first base double play.
Happened earlier, right.
Two innings, he got to the dugout, and Eddie goes, "You don't let that guy tag you like that. You got to make sure you like either slide or knock his ball down. He can't be tagging you like that." Unbelievable, same play.
I would say
either Eddie Murray must be like his guru mental guy because he was the hitter and he had the same chopper. So even, I'm like, is he teaching this guy a lesson? But the same spot, Vina comes in all full of confidence, and Albert just plowed him, like, knocked him out. I think he gave him a concussion because the guy was kind of punch drunk after that.
Yeah,
he was like, we got into a fight after that. I think he got drilled. But there was some back and forward and the bench clear and stuff like that. But that was all, like, taught by Eddie Murray because he didn't want Albert to get doubled up like that.
So we go down the rest of the year, and you guys get to the World Series. First time in so many years. It was phenomenal for the city. To draw the Braves in the World Series, how difficult of a draw was it, given the great pitching that they had?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we still thought that we could beat them. We knew they had great pitching. Just like the command that they had and the strike zone was a little wide.
Yeah.
I know the umpires, like one time I asked the guy, you know, that ball's like 3 or 4 inches outside. I mean, nobody can hit that, but you guys can do the same thing. I said, we're trying to hit the spots, but we don't get there. Like the ball runs back to the zone, they hit it. But they had an incredible command, and Maddox and Glavin, when they have a wide zone and they knew how far they could go, it was going to be very difficult. I remember seeing some of our guys swinging and the helmet falling off because they couldn't reach the pitches outside. And
they felt they had to swing at those because those were being called strikes.
Correct. I believe if the strike zone is like it is now, we win that World Series. If it's like it is now, because you have to throw the ball in 17 inches. Not like you can throw 22 or 23. It's hard to cover both sides of the plate.
Yeah.
And not taking away nothing away from Glavin and Maddox, but it's a little bit more difficult to pitch now.
So you guys lose in 6 games back in 95. Were you happy just to get there in the sense that, you know, this hadn't happened in the city in a zillion years, and you guys were the first team in many moons to get them to the World Series? What was that mentality?
So we were not happy to get there.
To lose, obviously.
Yeah, we wanted to win the World Series because you don't even know when you're going to get there again.
Yeah.
I didn't realize we were going to be back in 97, but we knew that we had a good team that we could repeat in 96, 97, and 98. That window was there. It's hard to get there, man. It's so hard. It's like, we were ecstatic that we made it, and we made it a fight, 6 games against Atlanta Braves. They were a stacked team, too. But, no, we were not completely thrilled to lose it. But, yeah, we were ecstatic that we gave the city and our fans an opportunity to be in the World Series.
So what happened the next year? I can't imagine a team that got to the World Series would get bounced in the first round, but there you won.
You have 3 bad days.
Yeah.
Or you know, and you're out.
That's the five.
Yeah, remember you? I think that we played against Baltimore, right?
Right.
Yeah, Baltimore was stacked too. They're as good as we were.
Yeah.
And they had a great series against us, and then bounced us out.
That's crazy. Because then the next year, as we go to 97. On your way to the World Series with a totally different team. Marquise Grissom's there in center field. What a tremendous pro he was. I'm sure you would say that as well. But so you get to the World Series again. You go past Baltimore. You beat Baltimore to get to the World Series. Everything was going your way.
John, we played 3 World Series that year. We played the Yankees.
Yeah,
nobody gave us a chance. And I'm not even talking about my at-bat. You're saying that we played three tough teams, like the Yankees. Going to Baltimore, we like, ooh, this is going to be a tough task. I think when we got to the World Series, some of our guys were spent. Because, okay. Like, not physically. I say more mentally, because you know how
they act. Wiped out mentally.
It's just like, after you beat Baltimore, everybody said, oh, these people are going to win. I mean, the Marlins came in a different direction. They were the wild card team. And they came in and they kind of like shocked the world. So the Braves got the same medicine that they giving other people. You know, the strike zone was huge in that game with LeVar Hernandez was pitching. There was balls or foot outside that were being called by Eric Craig.
Yeah.
And by the late Eric Craig, actually, he passed away. Those balls that he was throwing to Fred McGriff, Kenny Lofton, those guys, it's embarrassing. Those balls were this far outside. So it goes to show you that 95 was kind of similar, okay. But not the same. But the Marlins had good pitching. And they had they have kind of like an intriguing offense. They have speed, they have power throughout the lineup too.
Yeah, they were a very good team, and as franchises go, they get, you know, they were young, they made it there, and you have to give them credit because then they also kind of, you know, got rid of all their assets, and then they got back again mm-hmm. a few years later. So you got to give them credit. All right, let's go to Game 7. I mean, you've certainly spoke of it for years. We were down there interviewing you guys. Just that ninth inning was just so tough.
Yeah, it was. When you have the lead that you bring your closer in, you pretty much think you're gonna win the World Series. You gotta be positive about it. It's an unfortunate day for Jose. He didn't have his command. He didn't have it. And I don't want to sit here and criticize Jose, because Jose is one of the reasons why we got there.
100%.
Saving over 40 games. I mean, without Jose, we would not make it to the World Series. He just had a tough night that night. He was spiking the fastball. His slider was flat. So he basically was kind of like grinding it out there, and they took advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. They did, and obviously they won the World Series. Mm-hmm. That affected him a lot, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I think it did. Mentally, I mean, everybody started trashing him and, you know, like kind of like, you know, not appreciating the things he did. And in reality, Jose did so many good things for us, this organization and his family that he don't deserve that. And I almost see it like the what's the first baseman for the Cubs? The ball went between his legs.
Buckner.
Yep. I almost see it like Buckner. When the Cubs won the World Series, they brought him in to throw the first pitch or forgive him. We got to win the World Series if we can forget Jose, I guess, the fans.
Yeah.
But I think other things that happened is that him and Omar had that thing going with hit by pitches, and I don't know. I just tell Omar, I say, Omar, you gotta keep that down. You gotta stop. It started by him yelling at Jose one time, joking around from the bench, and then Jose took it personally and started drilling him. But I mean, I think that they're over that.
Yeah, I think they are. How is he doing? Do you ever hear from him, talk to him at all? I mean,
I talked to Jose a few times. Yeah, okay. He's fine with his family. He has a farm in Dominican, and one of his kids is playing, Jose Jr., and he's a pitcher. But yeah, he's fine. He doesn't lose any sleep.
Yeah, I tell you what, it was quite the experience for me and cameraman Herb Thomas when we went down to the Dominican after the 95 season, and we were there for winter ball, and we hung out with Jose and his wife. We hung out with a lot of the ball players, and I think that's the first time we saw Terry Francona. That was his first stint as a winter league manager. We was becoming a manager, as it were. So go back away. But I can still remember going to the little ball field and the home that Jose grew up in. Very humbling experience to see what it meant to him to get out of that area and to make a name for himself in Major League Baseball. It showed me just how precious baseball can be for some young people.
Yeah, it's incredible how these Latin American countries, like Puerto Rico is similar to some kids come out from nowhere, a little bitty town that ballparks full of rocks, and you're taking ground balls there. And if you could take a ground ball there, you can come to a carpet later on. Like Omar Vizquel, he can tell you the stories, because those guys are driven to get out of it, give their family a better life.
Yeah, they really are. I remember being watching a game and covering one game down there, and Sammy Sosa was playing in Winter League, and interviewing him, and how he said, my number one goal before I got to the bigs was to be able to build a concrete home for my mother. It was very big because we came from very modest circumstances, and this was my opportunity to do that for my family. And obviously he did so much more, and that's what baseball has been able to do for a lot of kids from the Latin countries.
Absolutely, 100%. It's an avenue for them to go and support their families. And a lot of these kids that come from those countries, they do their best to learn English and to prepare themselves prior to get drafted or signed to become a Major League Baseball player. They give everything they have. If they don't make it, it's because they weren't good enough, but they try.
Well, certainly one of the greatest success stories from down in the Dominican is the star of your team right now, is Jose Ramirez. What he was able to do to even get noticed, to get a very small signing bonus and make it to the big leagues. What's it been like just dealing with a guy of his caliber and his determination while you're here on the coaching staff for the Guards?
Phenomenal, man. He is the guy you want to build a team around, because his excitement and how he hustles, and he is a leader by example. If you're going to come play for the Cleveland Guardians and you don't run balls out, then you take a look at your leader right there. Everybody has to follow that.
He'll let you know, man.
And that's why he'll let you know, too. Hey, you got to run that ball out. And it helps to have a young team to do that. I explain to people, it's not sustainable for everybody to run 100% all the time if you're getting older. But if you have a young team, you have to do it, man. Everybody's trying to model the Cleveland Guardians right now. You see teams trying to be going young, mm-hmm. and stealing bases and stuff like that. So Jose was a perfect guy to have here for many years.
It's always great to sit down and chat with Sandy Alomar Jr., one of my favorite players on the team from years back to the current situation with the Cleveland Guardians, and Sandy over there at first base coaching. Just one of the great personalities in the game and outstanding people in the sport of baseball. And by the way, the entire interview with Sandy, including views of the 2023 Guardians, the new rules in baseball, all of that other stuff that we had, it will all be in the full interview that I did with him that's posted on my other podcast, which is the Guardians of the Land MLB podcast on the Press Play Podcast Network. Just go there. There's many other podcasts on that network, and check out the full interview with Sandy Alomar Jr. Just a great, great time chatting with Santos Alomar, one of our favorite good guys in the sport of baseball. And as for Telich Talks, please subscribe and follow to help grow the pod. And if you have any questions or such, jrtelich@yahoo.com. It's all lowercase, jrtelich, T-E-L-I-C-H, @yahoo.com. That's it for this week. Have a great one, gang. We'll see you the next time around with another edition of Telich Talks.